Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. Our goal is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices addresses how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of changes in our society. Today we're going to talk about something that if you're not aware of, you will be real aware of after we get done, and that is that there are real cuts on a national level by the new administration in Washington to the Environmental Protection Agency. So we're going to talk about how this new administration's funding proposals will affect, and in some cases drastically or dramatically cut environmental protection programs. The current budget goal for the administration is to cut EPA funding by about 31% in order to increase funding for defense programs and immigration enforcement. How that's going to affect our community is something we're going to talk about today, and it will probably affect that community, ours, in a lot of ways that we don't even get a chance to talk about now, because I suspect a cut of 31% in a major institution of federal government is something we can't cover in 59 minutes, but we'll see what we can do. I want to also remind you this is a call-in program. If you'd like to participate in the discussion, the phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. And I encourage you to call in early in the program. Sometimes when you call in the last 10 or 12 minutes, we don't get enough time to really give your topic and your concern the attention you'd like it to have. My guests today are Kathleen Carley. She is the Health Promotion Division Manager for the San Luis Obispo County Public Health Department. Larry Allen, who is the Executive Director of the Air Pollution Control District. And actually, I guess he's technically the control officer for that agency. And we'll talk about what APCD does, even though everybody seems to know what APCD is. I think a lot of people don't understand what the latitude of their activities are. And then Lexi Bell, who's the executive director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. That should have been an easy word. Sorry about that. Anyway, we want to take a look at how the proposed cuts in EPA are going to affect local programs, how they're going to affect health issues, how they're going to affect how we live our lives, how our ocean and our bays are dealt with locally. And even though it's a local issue, as is often said, all politics is local, so how we look at this are going to be a number of factors that are going to come into play. Kathleen, I'm going to start with you because I think a lot of people probably have no idea what the health promotion manager does at the county health department. So why don't we start there and let's find out what it is that you promote as far as health.
Well, our health promotion division is broad. We have five main program areas: our WIC program, our tobacco control program, injury prevention, oral health, and then something we call community wellness. In regards to the topic we have today, we have a program in community wellness called Outside In Slow. We take health and climate change personally, and it is a climate change education program to educate the public about the real health impacts of climate change. And the program was developed in response to many people not believing that climate change was real. And so our goal was to educate people that, yes, climate change is impacting us and it has real health impacts. For many people, if they think of climate change, if I had all of you close your eyes and imagine a picture of climate change, we'd probably all come up with a picture of a polar bear sitting on an ice floe by himself in the middle of nowhere. And that may be true, but climate change also has health impacts on the air we breathe, the water we drink, on our mental health status, on the vectors that we're exposed to. So our goal with our program was to educate people. And hopefully through this education, they would be able to have a real connection with the impacts of climate change.
The issue of climate change, for a lot of us, we thought was a the issue is not settled, but whether or not it's a real problem, we thought was settled. But we still seem to have a lot of people that that somehow think it's an issue of it's an issue that's not really affected. Let me quote Senator James Inhofe recently said, what I want them, the EPA, to do is to do what they are supposed to be doing concerning the environment, the water, and air. I'd like to see an EPA there to actually serve people and make life better for them, but went on to say they are going to have to start dealing with science, not rigged science.
Right.
And this is a man who I believe believes that most of what is thought of by reasonable scientists in the United States is indeed the rigged science.
Right.
So how do we balance that kind of thing out? Because you started with the issue of global warming
right.
as a key factor.
Right.
So
I think that if you look at opinion polls, particularly in California, but even national opinion polls, most people have come around that climate change is real. I think some people still dispute, is it man-made or is it natural? But, you know, public opinion polls in California, 80% of the population believes climate change is real, it's man-made, and it's impacting us now. So I think sometimes John Oliver did a great segment once where he put it like, okay, so 50% of the population doesn't agree and 50% does. And he goes, no, that's not correct. 98% of the scientists in the world agree that climate change is real and it's not rigged science, and you got 2%. So he said, if you want to have a real debate, you should have 98 scientists debating two scientists, and then that would be a better representation of what's really going on in the scientific community. So I think sometimes we think, well, it's really 50-50. It's not. I think our populace is much smarter than that, and I think there's consensus that climate change is real and it's man-made.
By the way, that's a very good segment that he did. He also included
yeah.
Bill Nye, the science
yeah,
guy,
yeah,
in
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And anybody who'd like to see that video, if you send an email to the email address I'll give you at the end of the program for Central Coast Voices, I'll gladly send you a link to that. I've sent it to many people.
Yeah.
Lexi, let's look at what the estuary program is and how that's affected by funding from the EPA and how the EPA sees what you're doing.
Sure. The estuary program is part of the Clean Water Act, actually, which is the law that EPA is responsible for implementing to keep our coasts' waters clean and our flowing rivers and creeks clean. And the National Estuary Program is a special designation that estuaries can achieve if the federal government says, yeah, that's an estuary of national significance. We need to protect it. We need to protect water quality there. And we are lucky enough to have that designation here in Morro Bay. The reason why we have that designation is because the community in Morro Bay wanted to get that designation. There was a very large, widespread community effort, and about starting around the early 70s, there was some talk of developing Morro Bay into sort of a Newport Beach kind of bay, harbor, marina development, and a lot of folks locally came together and decided that wasn't what they were looking for the community, and created a task force, did research studies, had a State of the Bay conference, all driven by the community, and they discovered this National Estuary Program designation. So that's what we need, because the National Estuary Program designation provides some funding from the EPA as long as you're meeting very specific requirements, and some structure, but the organization itself can be structured however the community wants. And so we were able to create a local independent nonprofit. We do all voluntary work. We're not regulatory in any way. We are our own nonprofit, independent from the EPA, but we are able to get this funding that we bring to our community to achieve water quality improvements, and it allows us to bring in much more other money than we would otherwise get without this support of federal funds. It also puts us on the stage nationally with San Francisco Bay, Puget Sound, New York, New Jersey Harbor, all these really big systems. And I think that's important because Morro Bay is special. It's rare to have a functioning estuary system on the coast of California that people can interact with, that has clean water, people can swim there, we can grow oysters there, and it's just as important to protect those places that are functioning and working well for our community, in addition to providing money to places that are in much dire straits.
Let me try and make a comparison with you, because from the information you sent to us to review, there's only two other estuary programs or designations of national estuaries in California. One, San Francisco Bay, which you mentioned. The other one, I guess, is Santa Monica Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Comparing Santa Monica Bay, what is it that would make Santa Monica an estuary in the same category at all with someplace like Morro Bay? I take San Francisco out of the mix because it's a gigantic bay, and if you can't figure out that it's fed from many sources, that's probably something we don't have the time to go into. So how do you compare what Morro Bay is doing compared to, let's say, Santa Monica?
Right. So our definition for an estuary is where the river meets the sea, where freshwater and saltwater mix. And so Morro Bay is a classic estuary. We have a good amount of freshwater coming in when it's raining and the tide mixing in. Santa Monica is more what they call an open bay estuary, so it has less direct river input, but it's very critical because they have huge issues there with losing their wetlands, which are areas that protect communities from flooding and provide really important habitat. And they have, you may have been reading about the LA River and the work they've had to do to try to make it into a river again. And so the other reason why we're kind of in the same category, even though the systems are different, is that the estuary program takes this watershed-based approach. So basically, we think about the whole system, regardless of what city or county or state parks, whatever entities are there, all doing their own thing, managing their piece. We look at the whole watershed, so the entire system that impacts estuary. And so all of the estuary programs do that, the 28 across the country. Even though their systems may look different, we're all taking this holistic approach, and we're a place that community members can come together and talk about what they want for their bay, thinking at the big picture level.
Good point. Thank you. I want to remind folks that this is a program that's available for you to be part of the discussion with. This is Central Coast Voices. We're talking today about the ramifications and the real costs of cuts in the national EPA and how it will affect the Central Coast, how it will affect the state of California and the nation generally, but specifically how it will affect those of us pretty much from Ventura to Monterey County, and that's what we're looking at today. Larry Allen, who is the Air Pollution Control District Officer for San Luis Obispo County, again, we all seem to know what the EPA, but what the APCD is, but tend to not really understand what the ramifications of the work is with it on a regular basis. However, you've been in the news just a little bit in the last couple of years about issues of dust control and the Pismo Dunes. But give us some overview of what responsibilities you actually have, and then we can look at how the EPA affects all three of the entities we're looking at here.
Sure. Thanks, Fred. The Air Pollution Control District is a special district that's mandated by state law, and we have a number of mandatory requirements to fulfill both at the state and federal level. We regulate, all sources of emissions above certain threshold levels. We have about 1,000 or greater than 1,000 facilities under permit in the county, and we do regular annual emissions inventories to look at what our total emissions are for all of the regulated pollutants that we monitor. We have a very strong air monitoring program with about 10 air monitoring sites throughout the county, including three down in the South County. We have a compliance and enforcement program that makes sure that the businesses that are under regulation are complying with the rules and regulations that affect them. And we also have a very strong public outreach program as part of that, an education program to help those businesses understand what's coming down the road and make sure that they're prepared for any new regulations that might be coming down the pipe. We assist them in a lot of ways through a very large incentive program where we provide about $1 million a year in grants from state and local funds that help folks comply early with regulatory compliance. And so there's been some really large requirements coming down from the state in recent years on diesel-fueled combustion emissions from all types of equipment, from on-road large hauling trucks down to ag water pumps out there, and we have actually provided millions of dollars in funding to help them comply with those regulations and put new engines and equipment in place. And so that's a really strong program, and at the same time provides a lot of education to the public and to the businesses about the health effects of those emissions and why cleaning them up is really important. Folks may have seen this year some burning happening out there. We have we work with Cal Fire and state parks and other entities to implement open burning programs that allow folks in certain areas outside of urban reserve lines and local communities to actually do some backyard burning on permissive burn days when our meteorologists in-house will look and see if dispersion is appropriate for allowing that. There's a set season for that, so that's a pretty large impact on our staff resources to run that program. And then we also work with Cal Fire and state parks on prescribed burning to try and allow them to burn areas that have been overgrown and present a risk of catastrophic wildfire if they're not maintained. So that's pretty important. We do a lot of review of new development projects that are above a certain level to make sure that any air quality impacts from them are mitigated to the greatest extent feasible. And then we also have a pretty strong climate program where we assist local governments in developing and implementing climate action plans and putting the word out to the public on what they can do in terms of their share for that and clean energy and conservation and so forth.
I was surprised to hear, as I understand it, that you actually have a program. You may not still have this program, but at one time you had a program that worked with the agricultural community to replace agriculture or farm equipment that wasn't compliant anymore. And I was surprised. I guess there was a program where people could actually work with you to replace things that were not compliant anymore.
Correct. And that program is still in place. And it's part of our incentive program. But what we try and do, there's the state laws on the equipment that has to reduce its emissions and essentially be replaced. And it's quite complex. And so our staff are very well versed in all the nuances of that. And what we do every year when we're looking at designing, you know, who are we going to try and provide grants for, is we look at who's the next industry that's going to be affected in this coming year, and we want to try and target the funds to them because they have a schedule that is sequential on all these different entities that are affected. And so agriculture has been affected a couple of times, you know, moving down the line of regulations. And so when they're coming up, we try and target funds to them through our incentive programs. And so we have replaced a lot of agricultural water pumps and irrigation engines and so forth out there in helping them to comply with the state regulations.
Okay. Let's get it off the table because it's on the table, I think, for a lot of people, and that is your agency and you personally have taken a lot of heat in the last 24 to 36 months over the issue of regulation of dust control, primarily in the Pismo Dunes. Those people who use the dunes for off-road vehicle purposes have to say that they've been vocal and opinionated about the APCD is probably an understatement. So let's at least get that out there. Let's get your perspective on what it is that was really going on with that issue, and we'll go from there.
Well, we've been taking a lot of heat actually since 2010 when we released our study on the impact of the vehicle activity out there in generating dust emissions. But we are working very closely with the Air Resources Board and with state parks to try and find a resolution to that issue. All of the studies, scientific studies that have been done, and there's been millions of dollars spent in doing these studies by both our agency and by the state parks, show that the riding areas are significantly more emissive than the non-riding areas. That is just established fact. And so there's really no question in our mind as to what is causing the issue, even though people want to continue to persist in saying that, no, it's all natural. It is not natural. And but there's a natural component. There's no doubt about that. And we believe that the data shows that, you know, probably 75% of it is caused by the vehicle activity, primarily through disturbing the soil out there. And so that the riding areas tend to be much more emissive than the non-riding areas. And they're physically different when you walk through them. You can tell the difference immediately when you step onto a non-riding area compared to a riding area. The sand is much softer in the riding areas. It's easier to kick around. You kind of walk on top of it in the non-riding areas. That said, it is a very complex issue. And we are not trying to shut the dunes down, as many people would have you believe. We don't shut facilities down, you know, that are regulated by us. We work with them to come into compliance, and that means trying to find ways to reduce the emissions in the riding areas and bring them down to background levels through planting of vegetation, addition of wind fencing and sand fencing out there, anything that can reduce the movement of the sand and prevent it from getting airborne. And if we can successfully do that, we believe that the, you know, 60 to 90 violations of the air quality health standards that we see every year out there could be reduced by about 75%.
And you have people who are still unhappy with what you've the compromises that you've made and the balances that you've come up with. There is still a lot of the dune users that are not happy with where you've gone with this.
Well, there's certainly dune users are unhappy. I would say that the folks downwind that are actually breathing it are very unhappy that we have not made further progress. And I don't blame them. I mean, it's been a long time, and it's been a very difficult issue. It's become politically charged, and a lot of misinformation has been put out there that has gotten in the way of reaching easy resolution. I feel like we're on a path right now that this next year we ought to see some really good results. The Air Resources Board has done some very sophisticated and expensive atmospheric model development to help really kind of characterize the problem and be able to actually analyze what it's going to take to resolve it. And so we hope to have some results actually on that to present to our board in June.
Okay. Thank you. I want to remind folks that this is a call-in program if you would like to be part of this discussion. This is Community Public Radio, KCBX, and you are our community. We thank you for your support during Spring Pledge Drive and keeping KCBX on the air and active and part of the discussion in many areas. You can give us a call today at 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. So now's the question, I guess, that a lot of organizations that are involved in trying to endear themselves in some cases to not losing funding from federal programs, and we are looking at a different set of challenges. I mean, I can be candid about this in saying that the state of California was not a state carried by the president in the last election. So it could be said, gee, California just doesn't agree with this administration, but we have a lot of citizens who obviously did vote for and support this administration. But it's looking at what it's going to do to your overall budgets. And I realize this puts all three of you in kind of a precarious position to have that kind of question presented, because you don't want to tick off the federal government when they have a checkbook. Okay. So having said that, I'm going to start with Kathleen. What are you doing to look at ways in which the EPA funding may affect things that you do? And what do you do to make sure that programs are not adversely affected long term?
Well, my program specifically does not get any EPA funding to do what we do. We've been able to fund it internally. Our environmental health division, I cannot speak for them, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to not say much on this. We do have a lead education program, but it's very minimal funding that we receive to do education of young families, and so that may be impacted. But right now, a lot of the work we do, we fund it internally, and we will continue to do it, whether the EPA is their budget is cut or not. So we're in a pretty enviable position.
Yeah.
Enviable in a way we're not going to get a budget cut. Not enviable because we have very little money to do what we want to do. So we're still going to struggle. Yeah. But we're not going to be impacted by cuts at the federal level.
Yeah. Well, I wonder whether or not when county health generally needs
right.
to look at environmental issues and environmental funding,
right.
you may not be getting funding from a lot of the things
right.
that come from a federal level.
Right.
But if my department were right. losing funding and I had to say, gee, I need to look at who else I can
right.
I can get some long-term help with, have there been any discussions agency-wide about that?
Not yet. Not yet. I still think it's too early to know what's going to happen.
Okay.
You know, but I do know our environmental health division is pretty self-sustaining, and they sustain themselves through the fees they charge to do these things that they have to do. So there may be impacts long-term, but I think it's too early to know right now.
Okay. We've got a call from Larry in Oceano. I want to give him a chance to get on the line. Larry, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, you're part of the discussion. Jump on in.
Well, yeah, this is for Larry Allen. Larry, you've been talking about the dust quality over Napomo, over the Napomo area dunes. I live in Oceano. In fact, I live right on the beach. You know, they have an entranceway that has been, it's supposedly a temporary licensed entranceway. It's for 35 years it's been temporary, and the license is coming up now. What about the concerns of the air pollution for the community of Oceano that has to withstand up and down? In other words, there's no way out of those dunes. You come into the dunes and you have to go back. Plus the fact that what we have is Pier Avenue with engines running constantly, the dust quality on the avenue. And I don't see it monitored down here.
Yeah, hi Larry. Thanks.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good, thanks. We have done monitoring down there as part of our special studies. And
well, if you have, you'll find it at the highest level.
We have found some high concentrations in certain specific areas down there, and primarily those
right by my house
that are closest to Pier Avenue, where
yeah.
there's a lot of track out that occurs. So part of our regulation of that facility requires that they put in track out reduction devices that will reduce the amount of sand coming off of the vehicles as they leave the area. They've also been required to increase the amount of roadway street sweeping out there. And so hopefully that's...
Yeah, well, that creates more dust, by the way, but that's okay.
Yeah, and we don't have any real say over the access points to the area. That's really the county's responsibility.
Well,
the
Coastal Commission apparently doesn't have real say because they've been in cahoots with the OHV for 35 years.
I think they are looking at a more southerly entrance right now.
Well, we have done a study. It cost over $200,000 for a number of different ways in, and hopefully someday we would have the same benefit that the community of Pismo Beach has, where, in fact, you put up a couple of poles. You don't have to close any entrances down. And you start from the creek. What does bother a lot of the Coastal Commission people is the fact that the creek is being driven over, and that seems to disturb them more than the dust quality seems to disturb them.
I would agree.
Yeah, Larry, thanks for your call. I think it probably needs a broader discussion, and it certainly needs a discussion that goes beyond the APCD. But I thank you for your observations.
We've been talking about it for 40 years.
Okay, don't have a solution for you, but I think you bring up a very valid point. Thanks for the call. I think this is something that you probably hear about a lot, though, because there are agencies like, county engineering, I believe, controls the road access when it's off the state parks portion of the land. The Coastal Commission is involved with how land use is used. And having been in some events with you before, it does seem like everybody believes that that nobody's doing anything.
Yeah, and that's certainly a valid belief out there, because it's just kind of been mired in controversy and inaction for quite some time. And I really kind of hate to get this discussion going down that path when we're dealing with the EPA path, because I think that I'm more than happy to spend time dealing with that on another program. But I think here it'd be better to stick to the topic.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's see. We've got Rachel from Morro Bay on the line. So, Rachel, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks. Well, this is a question for Lexi at the SGY program. I was wondering, I've been hearing a lot about sea level rise and how that's going to keep increasing over the next decades. And I was wondering if the SGY program has any idea about how that's going to affect our local area here.
Sure. Thanks, Rachel, for calling in. Yeah, we do a lot of work on sea level rise and other climate change impacts at the Estuary Program. We really focus on what trying to better understand what the future is going to look like for the watershed and the estuary, and planning our projects to both get results now for improved habitat and water quality and also in the future. So there was a recent study by the U.S. Geological Survey in our area that showed within 100 years we're going to see significant sea level rise in the bay, particularly in the area that's the salt marsh. So if you're familiar with the drive between Morro Bay and Los Osos on South Bay Boulevard, there's that marshy area just next to the road. We're anticipating most of that will be underwater in the next 100 years or so.
Wow. That's a big difference. Is there anything that we can do about that?
Well, there are some things we can do. We have to balance the differences in what we can do as a local community and what we can do as a global species. But locally, we have some really good options in terms of how we manage our habitats and runoff and flooding issues. So if that all area goes underwater, then we have a lot less buffer to flooding on that road, in Morro Bay, at the state park, in Los Osos, and the houses along the water. And so looking at ways that we can better manage our on-land water resources in terms of infiltration, improving stormwater runoff, and also improving erosion issues that are really bad during flood events, and then you're dealing with erosion problems in addition to flooding, and then also looking at habitat protection. So trying to protect lots of different kinds of habitats and open areas, because that allows animals and plants to maybe transition to different areas. It also provides us the possibility that if we have, you know, all more areas protected, we can improve that flood protection and the other benefits that we get from that part of the bay. But we also have to do some adaptation too. So recognizing we're likely going to see sea level rise, how do we adapt to that future scenario? So both looking at managing resources now and in the future. And adaptation includes lots of discussions about what we want that infrastructure on the water to look like, and how we can make it a little bit more resilient.
You know, Lexi, one thing I would add to that is that there's new requirements now in state law that require every planning agency in the state in their hazard mitigation plans to add a climate adaptation and our hazard planning element to that. And that has to be done, I think, by 2018 or 2020. It's coming up pretty soon, and that every update has to deal with that. And so that's a critical piece there. And we're also, you know, here locally, we're in the process of forming the Central Coast Climate Collaborative. And that is actually a collaborative effort between six different counties along the coast, from Ventura all the way up to Santa Cruz, also includes San Benito because they're always part of that tri-county group up there. And in three of the key priorities that have been identified for that group in working on common projects, sea level rise is one of those, water resources and drought issues is another one, and then energy, conservation issues and clean energy is a third. So we are looking at it, but the budget cuts, at EPA and at NASA and so forth actually are specifically targeting pretty much all climate programs nationwide. And a lot of the dollars for research specifically are being cut or proposed for being cut by this administration. And so a lot of the studies that we've been able to rely on and efforts by the USGS and other programs that are funded by EPA are on the chopping block.
I think that point relates also to what Kathleen said earlier, that we are seeing these results now, even though I talked about sea level rise in 100 years, we're seeing impacts and increased
Absolutely.
Flooding and other issues. And Californians are smart and pragmatic, and we're coming up with ways to start addressing that. I know City of Morro Bay is updating their general plan, local coastal plan combo, and they've integrated sea level rise into that. But you're right that without the federal support, it's harder to be more strategic across a large region.
Absolutely. And
very good point.
It's critical.
Rachel, thank you for the call.
Thank you, everyone, for your wonderful answers. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Okay, let's see. Okay, Rick, are you still there? Thanks for your patience.
Yeah.
Okay, you're on the air.
I wanted to address the effects on air pollution in San Luis Obispo coming over from the Central Valley, because if they cut the EPA funding, and not just the EPA funding, but also the pollution from vehicles. If they're saying right now that they're not going to enforce some of the rules governing emissions from vehicles, I understand a lot of the pollution that's coming over here from the Central Valley is particulate pollution from things like diesel trucks and whatnot. And it strikes me that it's kind of a serious problem, and part of it, I think, is that they talk about everything in terms of global warming and make it into a controversy, but there's no controversy about pollution. And I think that if we label things as pollution, they can't wheedle their way out of it by saying, well, global warming is disputed. They're disputing it.
Very good point. Thanks for the call, Rick.
One thing that I might point out related to that is that those cuts that are being proposed, those changes that are being proposed to actually undo, like, primarily the increase in fuel efficiency in motor vehicles, which has impacts on every aspect of air pollution and climate change and so forth. They've already been agreed to by Detroit, and they can actually meet those requirements. So to undo that is being depended upon by all the air quality agencies in the nation, and specifically in California, who needs those reductions in order to meet federal and state air quality standards. And, I think it's also important to point out in the budget cuts that are being proposed for EPA that one thing that people don't see is you mentioned the 31% figure in budget cuts. Well, it's actually – they're proposing a slight increase in two of the major funded programs at EPA, which are basically related to infrastructure for building clean water and drinking water infrastructure. And those account for like $2.3 billion in EPA's $8.7 billion budget. The rest of EPA's budget related to all other environmental programs is actually going to see a 43% budget cut. Okay.
So the overall cut that we're looking at is
massive.
Is is not affecting everything sort of equally, if you will.
No, I mean, they're looking at the infrastructure, building new water infrastructure and so forth. They're going to keep that program and actually enhance it. So those cuts would affect all of the other programs. They're pretty much doing away with climate change programs and, importantly, the research side of it. You know, if they want to debate the science, they're cutting out the science part of it. And so the information that we all relied on to make our decisions is not going to be there and available. So it's this sort of circular.
Can I play devil's advocate for just a second?
I won't say no.
Okay, thank you. So let's assume EPA does reduce their restriction, you know, allow greater emissions, et cetera. Do you actually think Cal EPA will go along with it, or will California still maintain our tighter controls that we've notoriously had, right? You hear stories about people coming in with cars from other states and they can't get them smogged here because they're so different. Will California maintain what we've had, or will
we
go along?
California is taking a very strong stance in a number of different ways. You may have heard some local speeches or recent speeches by Governor Brown on that, you know, we're going to maintain our climate programs and we're going to have our strong air quality programs and other environmental programs, and that is true. And so, in fact, there's actually legislation going through the California legislature right now, I believe it's SB 49, that would require that nothing get reduced from the point it was at on January 1st, you know, 2016 or 2017, whichever is more stringent, which it is sounds good, but there's a lot of implications associated with that. But getting back to the other part, California is able to have stronger programs on air quality specifically, and on vehicles, actually quite specifically, because of a special waiver program that California gets because they were the first air quality regulations in the nation. Mm-hmm. And so they have to apply every time they want to do something different nationally, they have to get a waiver signed off. So our more stringent requirements that are in place right now are probably protected, but if we want to continue to go further and mandate higher requirements than the federal government requires, we have to get a waiver every time we do that.
So it may not be funding, it may just be permissions.
Yeah, they could take that permission away, and then California, and there's 12 other states that pretty much follow what California does because they're allowed to. And so the tighter air quality requirements that are in place in those states could be affected if those waivers aren't continued.
Yeah. Thank you.
We have a number of calls, and I want to make sure we get a chance. So we may not get to cover this topic as thoroughly as we'd like, and we can cover it again, but I want to give our callers a chance. Mike from Atascadero, thanks for your patience. You still there?
Yeah.
You're on the air.
I have a question about the direct effect on the average person that lives on the Central Coast. And so you talked a little bit about the cuts in research and regulatory cuts, but in my experience in both nonprofit and the private sector, a 30-40% cut to an organization's ability to achieve its objectives might be the equivalent of a 100% cut. That is, a cut that massive might just undermine the organization's ability to achieve its basic goals. And so I was wondering if you could each of you talk a little bit about what a 30% cut in your program would look like, and more specifically, whether at the national level or from direct monies that you receive from the EPA, what a 30-40% cut would look like in terms of short and long-term consequences to the quality of life on the Central Coast. And I'll take my answer off here.
Great. Yeah. Thanks very much, Ed.
Thanks,
Lexi,
Mike.
Jump in.
Thanks, Mike, for calling in. That's a great point, because for our program, we are a line item within the EPA budget, and that line item designates a certain amount of funding to go to each of the 28 national estuary programs. And so a 30% cut across the agency is not likely to be a 30% cut on each line item. It is likely that there will be specific items taken off the table. And, in fact, there has been lists circulating in national news about the kinds of things they want to remove. And our program has been on some of those lists. So for us, a 30% cut to the agency may look like a 100% cut to the National Estuary Program. And it's a strange game. Because there is, you know, I think folks in D.C. want to support important programs. They also have jobs and offices and families and lives, and it's hard for them to send money, you know, out to other programs that are not seen by them, that are not part of their community. And on the other receiving end, the community, you know, we rely on that funding for a good portion of our operating budget because as a National Estuary Program, we are eligible for that grant annually as long as we're meeting our conditions. It is a stable source of funding. If you've worked in the nonprofit sector, you know that's pretty unusual. So we use that funding to cover things that are difficult to cover with other grants, like basic thing, rent, computers, you know, parts of our staff salaries. And so losing 100% of that funding not only reduces our money coming in annually, but also reduces our stability significantly.
Okay, good point. Larry, yeah. Jump in.
Yeah, from the air quality side, there's, you know, I'd like to speak to this from two different levels. At the local level, we have the blessing and the curse of not receiving much in the way of federal funding. And so locally here in San Luis Obispo County, we get about $70,000 a year from the feds on a $4.5 million budget. So a 30% cut in that is not going to be that significant. That said, throughout California and throughout the nation, there are many air quality programs that are almost entirely reliant on federal funding, or maybe even 50% of their funding comes from that. And some of the most polluted areas in the country fall into that category. And so the level of cuts that they're talking about are going to decimate many of the air quality programs throughout the nation. And particularly, they're going to hit hard in Southern California, in the Bay Area, in Sacramento areas that get huge amounts of federal funding to maintain their air quality programs.
Yeah. I would just add to that because the question was about Central Coast impacts, that many of those state programs that support air quality and water quality improvements are money coming in from the federal government going to state agencies that then grant it out to other entities to do good work. And so many of your local nonprofits and cities and county agencies are doing work to improve impacts to air quality and water quality on grants that are federally funded. So there's additional impact that's sort of hard to trace sometimes because it goes through a few layers.
Well, it's a definite ripple effect.
Yeah. Kathleen, you had said that you're not looking at direct issues of federal funding.
Not within my program at Public Health.
Okay. I'm going to make sure we're running a little short on time. Kathy, are you still there? Thanks for your patience. Kathy, you're on the air. Okay. I guess Kathy didn't have enough time. Sorry about that. I think that Larry's point a few minutes ago about the ramifications of how the balance of fundings are, and Lexi's point that you're not looking at somebody saying, okay, you're going to lose 30 cents on the dollar across all of your programs, figure out how to be a little more prudent. You're at this point not clear as to what you may lose funding on. Is there a discussion among estuary programs nationally about specifically what you think is going to be likely cut that you weren't anticipating?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the advantages of being part of the National Estuary Program is that we have these 28 other partners, some of them in, you know, much bigger, more populated districts than us. And we are having that discussion. We actually meet twice a year, all of us together, and exchange ideas about projects and programs and talking about how to better communicate what we do and why it's important and how to make our funding stretch as far as we can. But it's very, as Kathy said, for the health department, it's very unknown what's going to happen. It's just a big question mark, and there's been lots of rumors flying around. So trying to be prepared, but also trying not to run around with our heads cut off.
Yeah. We have Kathy. Kathy, thanks for coming back on the line. We just got a little bit of time. What was your thoughts on this?
I'm sorry. I just have a different question. Informational. I'd like to know the role of the Air Pollution Control District in the idling trains out near Rodriguez Adobe, southeast corner of the city.
Yeah. Thank you, Kathy. We have been working with Union Pacific and the city of San Luis Obispo to try and resolve that issue. We actually came to agreement and we're contributing funding in a three-way partnership to install a electric compressor out there that would eliminate the need for those idling trains out there.
Do you know the timeline on that?
Well, yeah. We had an agreement with Union Pacific, but once the attorneys got involved with the MOU to provide the funding and made a simple process into a complicated process, it's kind of stuck in legal limbo at the moment, trying to figure out who's responsible for what. And we have been trying to contact Union Pacific for literally weeks right now. So hopefully we will have an answer back to that, and we will be out to the community with more information. And I hope to have that thing in place this summer.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Sorry we kept waiting so long.
Bye.
Okay. We're just down to the last few minutes. Kathleen, let's start with you. I mean, as listeners know, I try and give everybody a couple of minutes at the end where I'll just stay out of the way. What is it that you think is most important for people to consider as far as environmental health issues for you?
I guess I would conclude by saying about a month ago I was asked to speak to a graduate class at Cal Poly, and the teacher said these students are very disappointed by what's going on. They're worried about EPA cuts. They're worried about the environment. What can you say to them to give them some hope? And I made two points. One, I said I think it's incumbent upon all of us to stay educated about the issues. You know, don't just read the media, study these things, you know, dig in a little bit deeper. You need to know what's going on. And the second point I made was I'd seen a TED talk that Al Gore did about 6-8 months ago, and he referenced the first TED talk he'd ever done and when it went back to Inconvenient Truth. And he said, at that time, I sounded the alarm. I didn't think we had a chance at overcoming this. And he said, but we've made a lot of progress, and clean energy sources are economically feasible, and that's the largest growth we're seeing. We're not seeing people want to do coal. We're seeing wind and solar, and we've exceeded all of our targets in clean energy from what we sent 10 years ago. And he said, try and focus on that. He said, economically, I think we're going to win this battle because it makes economic sense. So I tried to give the students something positive to focus on.
Good to think about. Lexi.
Thanks for having me on the show, Fred. I'd like to leave people with just a thought about being proud of our community. We have all this fabulous work going on to protect our health in terms of all sorts of impacts, and to protect our environment, which is really a key part of our health as well. And to feel ownership of that and get involved locally if you're feeling a little bit pessimistic on the federal level, because we can do a lot locally, but we also still have to make our voices heard as part of our nation. I also want to encourage folks that the National Estuary Program, we feel like we're here to stay. You know, big cuts to the EPA would be impactful to us, certainly, but we were formed by our local committee, our community, and we will try our darndest to do our great work no matter the things happening around us. And to encourage you to go to our website, because this year we just released our 2017 State of the Bay Report, which comes out every 3 years, and we have a number of fabulous events going on throughout April to celebrate our estuary and invite people to explore science and have a great time.
We're coming up on Earth Day. Okay. Larry.
Thanks again, Fred, for having us all here. And this is such a critical topic, climate change, and the effects of these budget cuts are real, and they will be significant. Hopefully they'll be far less than what is actually being proposed, because I think when the rubber meets the road, there's a lot of governors and congressmen that are looking at real reductions in funding to their areas. And so I'm hoping that this gets mitigated somewhat. But what I would encourage people to do is to definitely not just get educated, but get activated. Because climate change is really this issue that affects everyone in the entire world, and it's not going away. It is real, and the impacts are increasing daily. I mean, reading the news is pretty alarming when you see what's happening up in the Arctic with the lowest sea level ice ever recorded. You know, we have a Northwest Passage now that's pretty much permanent, and the melting of the Greenland, you know, land-based ice sheet, and you know, all of these things that are happening, they have all these ripple effects on our economy and public health. And the green economy that has been growing in trying to respond to these issues and reduce our reliance on fossil fuels and increase renewable energy is the fastest growing area of our economy. And we need to continue that, because those jobs in coal are not going to come back, despite what this administration says. And it's not because of regulations. It's because it's not economical. And if it does come back, they're going to be automated jobs, not putting people to work. We need to retrain those folks and get them involved in something that is going to last for the future, because climate change cuts across every environmental and public health issue. It's going to exacerbate every one of those. We need to deal with it at the local, regional, state, national, and global level. And we all have to become involved.
Good points for all of you. Yeah, very good points. Larry, maybe you shouldn't retire. he'll kick me under the table later on anyway. Thank you all for joining us today. This has been a wonderful discussion. It's a discussion I wish we didn't have to have, but it's important we do. This is Central Coast Voices. I want to remind you all, and thank you for joining us today, that this is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Our newest report, Vital Signs, Understanding San Luis Obispo County, came out last December. You can see that report at actionslo.org. Next week, you're stuck with me for a second week in a row, and I'll be speaking with peace advocates from the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation as we discuss the importance of being peace literate, and how violence creates trauma and contributes to the creation of more violence. And that'll be a very, very pointed topic for us next week. Chris Kington Barker will be back with you 2 weeks from now, sitting in this chair. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX. The program is also underwritten by a generous grant from Joan Gellert Sargent, and we thank her for her continued support. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org or 543-2323. And again, we thank KCBX and all of the listeners and supporters of KCBX for their efforts to keep this kind of programming active and vital in our community. And thank you to my guests, Kathleen Carley, Larry Allen, and Lexi Bell, for being part of the program today. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thank you for joining us.